This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman. Economic growth in Hawaii is slowing. Visitor numbers are slipping. More confirmation of that out this morning, as you just heard on the news. Hotel occupancy and profitability measures are down, and while unemployment's still relatively low at 2.8%, that's its highest level since the end of 2016. At the same time, several local publicly held companies have reported strong earnings in recent days and weeks, especially financial institutions. Just last month, the Council on Revenues cut its expectations for tax revenue growth for this year by more than a full percentage point to 3% on, quote, the expectation of lower economic growth and lower than expected tax revenue growth. The Council's next report's about a month away. The University of Hawaii's Economic Research Organization report last month included, quote, a more downbeat view of economic prospects than previously. Its next report comes out in about a week. Our first guest this morning is a big part of both of those groups, Carl Bonham on the Council of Revenues and the Executive Director of UHERO. Carl, thanks for coming in, and not asking you to sort of give away any forecasts, but on the trend line, you sound cautious about this economy.
Cautious is, yes.
A polite way of...
Yes. No longer so much cautiously optimistic, just more cautious. Mm. We've been talking about the prospect for slowing growth for a couple of years now. And then in our last report, we said, okay, it's here.
Yeah.
And it's continuing. Mm. Through March, we're growing total jobs at well less than half of 1%. As we expected, the data for 2018 was revised down sharply from 1.7% job growth to 0.6% job growth. So that was a much lower rate of growth of job growth, and that growth rate is continuing to slip. And you saw the visitor spending numbers from today. So in real dollars, that's more like a 4.5% decline. And so real visitor spending has been not slowing, but declining, right, since it peaked roughly March or April, maybe May of last year. It's just been on a steady slide.
And you were saying before that spending per visitor right now is at its lowest rate since 2010.
Since 2010.
Yep. In real terms.
Right.
So the broader implications of that in terms of the broader economy for Hawaii, how much of a hit does that represent?
Well, that's why you're seeing, in part, that's why you're seeing job growth as weak as it is and income growth as weak as it is. The major drivers of Hawaii's economy, obviously the big one is tourism. The sort of other large ones are state and local and federal government spending. Mm-hmm. Federal government spending and state and local government spending aren't adding growth to the economy. They aren't adding jobs to the economy. So if it's not tourism and it's not construction, I mean, so everything's kind of at a high level, right?
Right.
So don't get us wrong. Mm-hmm. The economy hasn't slipped dramatically. We're not in a recession, we don't think, at the moment. Mm-hmm. We're at this high level. We're just not growing. It's like the ship is just sort of stalled in the water. We're dead in the water right now.
And that's, you know, you look at trend lines in terms of, as an economist and looking at those overviews, and the trend lines are not necessarily encouraging at this point.
No, not at all. Yeah. For jobs, it's flat. For income, it's relatively flat. So roughly 1% real growth in income last year. For population, it's down.
You know, that's another factor that I wanted to talk about. And new census figures out in terms of the net out migration. Again, in terms of when you take into account international immigration to Hawaii and birth outpacing deaths in Hawaii, there is growth. But in terms of that net out migration domestically, basically more people going to the mainland, that has longer term economic consequences.
Well, it does. And So right now, we don't have data for the 2018 military population.
Mm.
If you look back at 2015, 16, 17, it's really military population outflow and their dependents.
Mm.
So between 2015 and 2017, we lost between 7,000 and 8,000 combination of – it was about 2,000 military personnel and about 5,000 dependents.
Mm-hmm.
And that accounted for most of that out-migration. We don't know what 2018 was. I mean, I don't have any knowledge of big troop movements or anything like that.
Right.
So it's highly likely that some of this is people sort of voting with their feet and saying, okay, so put the in our upcoming report, we'll have a chart that shows income growth by sector for the U.S. and Hawaii. And for the U.S. as a whole, you look at, say, construction.
Mm-hmm.
Income is growing very markedly, 4 or 5% real income growth in contracting nationally, not
Hawaii.
In Hawaii.
No.
So, you know, you have a choice of where you're going to live. And while we don't want to leave our families and our homes and so on, people do that. And so presumably some of that is what's going on.
So a more difficult question within that economically in terms of looking at what are potential engines or areas for growth, what do you see?
Well, in order to keep people here or bring our Keiki home or Kamaina home, you have to have the kinds of jobs that they want and that allow them to you know, make a living and afford the high cost of living. So all of those are at interplays. And so that, you know, there are many efforts at play trying to grow Hawaii's innovation economy.
Mm-hmm.
The university is focused on this. And we have an accelerator at the university now, Accelerate UH, that is trying to help entrepreneurs create new businesses. And some of those are businesses that will keep some people here.
Right.
And you know, this is very small, you know, although we have several accelerators in the state that are world class, right, that have won awards.
And success,
and we're making progress.
Success stories on a micro level, but seemingly it's a broader, almost changing mind frame more broadly when
absolutely.
You talk about a
yes.
macroeconomic direction for the state.
The if you're talking about a mindset change in the innovation space, that has definitely happened. But you've got to keep in mind that it's small. So we don't know. I mean, in our forecast, we're not forecasting that the population is going to continue to decline like it has.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, I mean, other things at play here are just demographic factors that, you know, have been at play for 20, 30, well, forever.
Mm-hmm.
We're simply having fewer children.
Right.
Right. Number of births and the birth rate has been declining in Hawaii. It never recovered after the Great Recession, which was it's pretty odd. Usually when the economy is doing really well,
there's
you have
bounce
more births.
Back, right.
It hasn't happened this time because it's being overwhelmed by the demographics. And this is true nationally as well. So we're not unique in that regard.
You know, you mentioned the military before. How much of a factor is that within the broader economy, and how do you track in terms of likely contributions? Because that's wrapped up with policy and other sort of intangibles, right?
Well, so if you look at total federal spending in the islands, it amounts to something like 16-17% of the Hawaii economy.
It's a big chunk.
Yeah.
Yeah. On another front, on the private sector front, we have been seeing bank earnings in particular just very strong and reflected not only in revenue growth but in something like, you know, stock prices up, you know, more than 20% in several cases so far this year. What does that reflect, or what, as an economist looking at that, what does that tell you? How significant? What do you make of that?
Well, without digging into those numbers, I mean,
and individual cases. Are,
I mean, and I hear this when I talk to friends who are in the banking industry on all the islands about, you know, their loan growth is good. They're not experiencing loan losses like we would during a sharper downturn. And the interest rate environment has been favorable. I don't know if their deposits are growing, what the, you know, average size. So in other words, does how well it connects to the overall
broader
health
picture
of the economy. Because you can have financial services industries do well even when the economy is not doing very well if the interest rate environment is changing.
So on that longer view of the economy, that broader view, what should people be watching?
I think people just, they need to be aware that the overall economy has slowed really markedly. And there's not a lot of reason to think that we're going to rebound to some of those sort of strong growth years like we saw back in 15, 16. And when you're growing this slowly, it doesn't take much to tip things over the edge. I mean, you talked about the rising unemployment rate. It's up almost 0.75%. And granted, it's still low, and people still talk about having a hard time finding workers and qualified workers. But it's not going to take too much of a continued slide in real spending by visitors for this growth rate to turn from slow to nothing.
Caution.
Yes.
Economic caution. Carl, thanks very much. Carl Bonham, Executive Director of the University of Hawaii's Economic Research Organization. Thanks for coming in.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the Mueller report with Washington Post investigative reporter Rosalind Helderman. She co-wrote the commentary and analysis in the Post publication of the report. We'll talk about the new things she learned that went beyond what journalists like her had already reported. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're dreaming of one of Hawaii's most beautiful destinations, an out-of-the-way place, far from sun, sand, and surf. It's off the beaten tourist track for a reason. It's an area of extremely heavy rainfall called a montane wet forest, rising at its highest level to some 4,000 to 4,500 feet above the Pacific. It's frequently shrouded in cloud cover. The trail's often made impassable by rains. There's a boardwalk to make access to the interior a little easier, but it can be a treacherous hike. Nevertheless, it's a haven for ornithologists, botanists, meteorologists drawn by unique geography and the rare endemic species that have managed to hang on. Not only trees, but also the last home of the o'o bird, hunted to extinction for its feathers, used to make the feather cloaks of Hawaiian royalty. Today, we're looking for its official name. If you know it, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Olelo Community Media. Live at the Legislature features Senate and House leadership discussing issues facing this year's legislative session. Mondays at 8:30 a.m. on Olelo, Channel 49.
Next week could be an important one for Hawaii's tourism industry. It's Golden Week in Japan, a string of holidays that's longer than usual this year. Figures out this morning from the Hawaii Tourism Authority show a drop of 40% in visitors from Japan to Hawaii Island in March. Among those looking forward to an extra boost of Japanese travelers to Hawaii is Ross Birch. He's the executive director of the Island of Hawaii Visitors Bureau, and he tells me he's heading into Golden Week with some optimism.
Well, it's in all indications being a little bit extended. It's helping all islands, as we're hearing. We know that our direct flights coming into Kona are at a higher load factor and are pretty full as they're coming in. So those are great indicators.
Now, in recent months, Big Island has seen pretty dramatic drop in visitors from Japan. In January, down about 20% year-on-year, and down nearly a third, actually, in February. Any sense of what's behind those declines?
Well, actually, year-over-year isn't as bad as it has been for the last few months of 2018. We're seeing some of that recovery coming back in the Japan market, where we had huge increases in the Japan market once the secondary flight from Japan Airlines came in after the Hawaiian Airlines has been in for a year. We saw a huge jump of 30-35% for the first 5 months of 2018. So to be 20% down from last year, the first 2 months of the year, actually we're still pacing ahead of where we were in 2017, which is a great sign for us that the numbers are starting to recover in that market, and it was the most volatile. We had a huge increase and then a substantial decrease of almost 30-35% as we kind of hit into the back end of the year.
And as you point out, this flights into Kona so important. What's ahead for that beyond Golden Week, and as you look out ahead in terms of 2019 and the summer?
We have two great partners that are actually in the process of becoming a one merged partner with Hawaiian Airlines and Japan Airlines, flying directly in from two different locations in Tokyo, which has been phenomenal for us in the Japan market. And we can't say enough about the support we've had in market from both Hawaiian Airlines and Japan Airlines with promoting their flights, the direct access, and all the wonderful things you can do on the island and experience. I mean, the Japan market it resonates very well with our island, and we've had some of the highest numbers throughout all the years from all the neighbor islands from the Japan market. It's just been kind of a little bump in the road for us through this last few months, and I feel we're going to be able to get right back into it.
And when you take that longer view of the Japanese market, what do you think folks should bear in mind looking ahead?
I think we've got some really good hotel product that has been renovated recently, another hotel that's under current renovations right now. I think we're going to have position ourselves down the line to kind of hit everything in stride with that Japan market and really set up well. You know, there have been years of decline we've had even previous to this when Japan Airlines left us in 2006. We had a little lag time before we saw some major dips in that market, and then we lost some of our Japan ground staff and support system here on the island. We're now getting back to the point where we're getting back to those levels we were in the 2006 time period, and seeing a great recovery from that Japan market.
And looking ahead in terms of the Kona Airport, you're not expecting any changes in that area in terms of declining opportunities there?
No, we're confident that both the Hawaiian Airlines flight and the Japan Airlines flight will stay in and be great partners with us at the capacity they're at. The Kona Airport itself is going through a current renovation, including the starting of a new FIS or a federal inspection station. So we'll have a new customs facility there, which will be very good for both of those flights and potentially any new flights wanting to consider Kona as their destination.
And more broadly, not only with Japan, but it's been nearly a year now since Kilauea started the most recent round of activity, and a challenging time certainly for the visitor industry on Hawaii Island. How's the recovery planning going and the strategy in terms of recovery?
Well, we've had two kind of different recovery responses, and thankfully from Hawaii Tourism Authority, their reaction and their ability to throw some additional funding our direction specifically for the island, we were able to get early on funding of about $1.5 million in the June-July time period, so we could do some of that message mitigation, so we could kind of slow down the impact of the volcano a little bit and kind of ease everyone as to the destination is still, it was still safe to come. It was an isolated area. We had, you know, very little direct effect from the volcano from an overall island perspective. And then once that had been through, and then at the end of August when things quieted down, we were seeing kind of a slower recovery as far as getting our numbers back to where we had, they were established in May and April before that. So Hawaii Tourism Authority, again, is coming through with an additional set of funding for the more of what I has referred to in a few other opportunities as kind of that defibrillator. We saw ourselves kind of come to this slowdown and kind of a bottom and out period, and now we're at that point of in the recovery and coming up, and we need a little bit of a little jump start to get us going, and that's what this funding is really going to do. We're going to hit the West Coast hard. We're going to hit our areas in Japan as well, specifically to get those numbers back as quickly as we can.
Anything else you think folks should be looking at?
We can see in our total numbers for the state that there was actually kind of a little bit of a softening kind of in the first 2 months statewide. That's a little bit concerning to me in our side, trying to specifically have our island in that recovery process. If we see a potential slowdown on a bigger scale, which I'm hoping that it's only because we had phenomenal jump start to 2018 is the reason why we're kind of seeing those numbers, and hoping we can get right past that and get through it. And our island is going to see great success with the new programs we've got in place.
Anecdotally, do you hear anything in terms of the Japan folks of encouraging or otherwise? Or
we've kind of had the double-edged sword with the volcano.
Yeah,
it was scary, and it pushed everybody away, and they're still in that danger mode a little bit, so we've had to tone that down a little bit.
Mm.
And now that there's really little to no activity going on, they're like, oh, wow. You can't win for losing is kind of what we're in right now, is you can't, okay, we had too much, and well, now
exactly.
We have too little.
Exactly.
So let's find that perfect amount in which we had. So the beginning part of 2018 was the volcano was working completely in our favor, and everything was just clicking in, and then we got a reality check. It's been interesting. I think I've been hit with every different thing you can in a 10-year cycle. So, you know, we'll continue to keep pressing.
Well, excellent. We'll appreciate the time, Ross. Thanks very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Ross Birch is the Executive Director of the Island of Hawaii Visitors Bureau. Nonprofit organizations are generally known for looking after tight budgets. There's a nonprofit rehab center here in Honolulu that has some very high salaries, among other costs, including as much as $500,000 a year for its executive director. Investigations editor John Hill of Civil Beat has been tracking these figures in this story, and he joins us for today's reality check. And John, that salary really is an eye-popping figure.
It really is. It's totally eclipses what other nonprofit drug rehabs, what they pay their executive directors in Hawaii. Interestingly, they compare themselves in their tax return to the Betty Ford Center, which is nationally known. Most people have heard of it and has many times the revenue.
And you mentioned also that sort of spreads beyond the ED. So, for example, substance abuse counselors, as you point out in your piece, generally make an average of about $43,000 in Hawaii. But at Sand Island Treatment Center, many are in the six-figure range.
That's right. Through the years, a lot of the counselors have been paid well into the six figures. And that is really extraordinary for drug rehabs. As you point out, the Bureau of Labor Statistics tracks what the average pay is for a substance abuse counselor in Hawaii, and it's much, much lower than that. Now, not all of these people were had the title counselor. Some of them were sort of counselor supervisors or clinical supervisors, but a lot of, for the most part, they were sort of in the counseling realm, and they were getting paid actually salaries comparable or greater than what executive directors at some of the other drug treatment centers get.
Now, in terms of the organization overall and how they get their revenue, where does their money come from?
Well, they get money from state contracts. So they have contracts with the Department of Health and the judiciary. They get referrals from courts. And they also, I wasn't able to ascertain how much Medicaid money they get, but presumably Medicaid pays for some of the treatment there. And in addition to that, this treatment center has for many years been on public land and has not had a lease or any arrangement with the city or state. This is on Sand Island. It's land that where the Sand Island Wastewater Treatment Plant is. And this treatment facility was there and has been existing there, and as far as I could tell, not paying rent for close to 60 years.
And on the cost side, any sense of how much money goes into their programming side and what the relative success of that operation is?
They do report a very high rate of success. It's a two-year program, residential program, and I was able to get from the Department of Health, which is one of the state operations that contracts with them, a report that they submitted in which they showed really stellar results. I asked the Department of Health if they verified those results or had any way to audit them, and I didn't hear back from them. So I'm not sure how those numbers compare to other rehabs and how they're verified by the state.
And speaking of not hearing back from folks, Mason Henderson is the executive director, didn't want to talk to you, and neither did any of the board members. But that sort of brings in that question of oversight in terms of the best practices with board directors in a situation like that.
It sure does. It sure does, yes. And there's a six-member board of directors that... Of course, a board of directors of a nonprofit is the entity that's responsible for setting the executive's pay. And in this case, there's an unusual situation with the board in that Mason Henderson, the executive director, is on the board. That's not all that unusual. I found other not drug treatment nonprofits in Hawaii that included the executive director, but also the chief financial officer, who is a paid employee of the Sand Island Treatment Center, is also on the board. And if you look at, for instance, the Better Business Bureau standards for nonprofits, they warn against having too many paid employees on the board. They say it should be no more than one, actually, in a case like this, because you want to avoid conflicts of interest. You want to have people who are truly, for the most part, independent on the board.
And with the organization at the center of their vision. This is a very detailed story. You can read it entirely at civilbeat.org. John Hill, the investigations editor of Civil Beat. John, thanks for being with us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
This week on Says You.
So pomp is like the gravitas, the associated kind of milieu that you're in, and circumstance is your place in it.
Would circumstance be the ceremony that's involved, and pomp be the attitude that professors have towards themselves?
A game as fast as it's fun, and everyone's a winner, Says You.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
First it was sugar, then pineapple, and now coffee has the informal recognition of Hawaii's signature crop, but many Hawaii coffee farmers argue that a state law is putting them at a disadvantage to other growers around the world. HBR's Ryan Finnerty has been looking into that. He joins us with coffee in hand to tell us about it.
Good morning, Bill.
Morning, Ryan.
And yeah, I've got a bag of coffee right here, and you might be able to hear it. And as you can see, it says very prominently displayed on it, 10% Kona coffee blend. And that's probably a pretty common sight anyone around Hawaii has seen. And I kind of got curious about the origin of that. And it turned out there was a bill at the legislature this year addressing that. So we decided to look into it. And that stems from a 1991 state law that the legislature passed that required any coffee that is labeled as being Hawaii grown or from one of Hawaii's coffee growing regions to have at least 10% coffee by weight from that region. So in this particular one, 10%, only 10% of the beans that are in this bag actually have to come from Kona.
And no sense of where the rest has to come from.
That's right. It can come from anywhere. It could come from another part of Hawaii. So you'll see sometimes blends that maybe have 20% Hamakua, 10% Kona, but more typically it comes from a foreign source, Central America, the Caribbean, Africa, because those tend to be cheaper. And so the real reason that this is done is to lower the price, because Hawaii-grown coffee is very expensive. And this law was enacted in 1991. It originally only covered Kona, so it was just Kona coffee. In 2002, state lawmakers expanded it to cover all of Hawaii's coffee-growing regions, which are outlined as Hamakua Coast, Kau, and Kona on the Big Island, and then Maui, Molokai, Oahu, and Kauai. And so any coffee you see that says Kauai grown or Kona grown or where, any of those regions, it has to contain at least 10% from that region. But the rest could come from anywhere. And that has a lot of coffee farmers upset, because they say it's misleading, it cheapens their brand, because you're not really drinking, in this one, a Kona coffee. You're drinking 10% of a Kona coffee, and the rest is something else, but it's kind of marketed as Kona. And so they have been pretty much every year since 1991 trying to get this limit, this minimum raised to 51%. And they feel like that will make it a more representative example of their product and improve the, what they say, improve the quality of the product. And so here's Suzanne Schreiner. She's a coffee farmer in Kona and also president of the Kona Coffee Farmers Association.
Well, the 10% rule effectively transfers money from farmers' pockets to large corporate mainland pockets. By using the Kona name, restaurants such as McDonald's or 7-Eleven get to say they're selling a Kona coffee. The value of the Kona name, and it actually degrades our name. So we'd like to see that changed so more money stays with the growers.
And so, as we mentioned earlier, this bag of 10% Kona coffee, 90% came from somewhere else. So that means 90% of what was paid for this bag didn't go.
Not Kona coffee.
Right. And the profits from that went to not a Kona coffee farmer. And so there's a number of economic issues at play with this. One is just that they want to get more revenue. You know, a 100% bag of Kona coffee means more money going to a Kona farmer. But it also sort of changes expectations, right? So this bag that I have here costs about $5. A Kona bag, 100%, goes for several times that.
That's a pretty huge price differential, actually.
Right. And so these farmers are arguing that it's deceptive, that a consumer thinks they're buying a Kona cup of coffee, but they're really getting something else, and that they're hurt by that. It decreases the price of coffee on a, at least certainly a national level, but potentially on a worldwide scale, for what people expect that they can buy Hawaii-grown coffee for, and then that influences what they can get. So they're trying to raise, as we said, raise the limit. And part of the reason is that Hawaii-grown coffee is considered a premium product on the world market because Hawaii coffee farmers have a lot higher expenses than other farmers do, the price of land, getting materials here, getting it shipped out. And so they feel that the lower price is hurting their ability to sell their premium product, the 100% blend, which is what they need to make a profit. But there's another side of this to this argument too, and that's the blenders. And this bag of coffee that I have here was roasted and prepared and distributed by a local company based in Honolulu. And those distributors say that were this limit to be increased, it would make their product uncompetitive, that the price would be too high, and those big corporate customers like 7-Eleven and McDonald's that Suzanne mentioned would no longer buy the product, and that would hurt the local industry as a whole. And so I spoke with Jim Lenhart, who oversees sales to those types of customers for the Hawaii Coffee Company, which is the largest single buyer of Kona coffee and has been for several decades. And I asked him how the 51% blend requirement would play out from his perspective.
Well, since it's hypothetical, let's say the 51% was enacted. One, there's not enough supply to take care of just my customers. From one company, I've got 800 customers across the state in food service, from hotels, convenience stores, restaurants. Two, the price of the coffee, the increase, would most likely not be accepted. As you probably know, the restaurant business is a pretty competitive business. And should the cost be a barrier for these customers, then they would stop buying a Kona blend.
And Jim told me, Bill, and he's been working in that business for quite a while, he said that in past incidents, he's lost a customer for an increase of low as 5 cents a pound. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're a McDonald's or a 7-Eleven, you're selling...
Cost is your driver.
Right. Yeah. And, I mean, you think about the amount of coffee by volume that someone of that size, or even a local business, a local hotel or a local restaurant, mm-hmm. is going through every year, 5 cents a pound really adds up. And so, as we mentioned earlier... A 10% blend, which could go for just retail, $5 a bag, probably even cheaper for these large wholesalers compared to what we'll hear from Suzanne again in a moment, $40 or $50 a bag for 100%. That makes a huge difference for them. And so as we kind of see, there's a situation where the interests of the farmers and then their distributors don't necessarily align up. And here's what Suzanne had to say about that.
We'd be happy if McDonald's stopped selling our coffee, because probably only 10% of the coffee that's grown in Kona is put into a blend. The other 90% goes to high-value consumer accounts on the mainland who are selling 100% Kona coffee for $49 or $59 a bag.
And so that's sort of the situation, Bill, is as farmers all around the world prices everything, and the farmers in Hawaii want to see the price they get for a bag of coffee go up. The distributors say that's not going to work for them and that it will hurt everyone in the long run. We should also say, though, that this is not a universal position amongst coffee farmers. There were several who opposed the bill at the legislature, which would have raised the limit. And these tend to be farmers who sell primarily to the distributors. So in Suzanne's case, she's selling the majority of her product as a premium product to a more boutique market, craft product. But if you're selling entirely to a distributor and that distributor decides to drop that because no one will buy it, then you're really in trouble.
And that's, you know, step one of business, know your customer in terms of the market there. And that's, I think, generally folks, you know, locally know if you're going to get real Hawaiian coffee, it's got to say 100%, and you're going to pay more for that. And then that's the choice on the consumer side that, yes, this is worth this, because actually in the end, this tastes a whole lot better than that blend.
And they make an interesting comparison, a lot of the farmers, to, say, Idaho potatoes mm-hmm. or champagne from France, that you would never buy. Idaho would never allow a 10% bag of Idaho potatoes to be sold, or France would never allow a 10% bottle of champagne to be sold. So they argue that this is what they need for parity with producers elsewhere in the world.
All right. Ryan Finnerty. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks, Bill.
If you want to see how coffee fits into Hawaii's overall agricultural production, we have a report from the Department of Agriculture posted with this story at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. In today's backyard quiz, we thought about a mountain rainforest and wilderness preserve on Kauai, a place that's often shrouded in mist from near constant rainfall. It's not far from Mount Wa'ali'ale, long renowned for its claim to be the wettest spot on Earth. Legend has it that Madame Pele created the 16 square mile wetland in a moment of anger by stomping her foot from the top of Mount Wa'ali'ale into a hot lava 1,000 feet below. Boardwalk's been built to make the 3.5 mile trail through the area passable, and it can be a spectacular hike. Dozens of waterfalls within view, view of Hanalei Bay at trail's end. Because of its elevation, nearly 4,000 feet, the trail gives hikers a chance to walk through the clouds. Today, it's a state-designated wilderness preserve, the Alakai Wilderness Preserve, popularly known as Alakai Swamp. That's today's quiz, and Ben in Lihue, who's been there many times and says it's majestic, he was the winner. If you got a quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Ben Hecht is a name you may or may not know. He was a Hollywood screenwriter active in the 1920s and 30s and 40s and beyond. Behind movies like The Front Page and His Girl Friday to Hitchcock movies like Spellbound and Notorious, he worked on Gone with the Wind and the original A Star is Born. But his politics are another fascinating part of his life, often forgotten until now. Two new books are out about Hecht, one of them written by Julian Gorbach, assistant professor at the School of Communications right here at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. His book is called The Notorious Ben Hecht, Iconoclastic Writer and Militant Zionist. It got a positive review in the book section of this past Sunday's New York Times, which, among other things, noted that he comes up with a surprising amount of fresh material on Hecht's activism. Before Ben Hecht ever wrote a screenplay, he was a crime reporter in Chicago, and asked Julian about how that experience influenced the rest of his life.
You know, that to me is a lot of why this is a fascinating story and why I chose to tell the story in a particular way. You know, by whether you call it synchronicity or coincidence, my book and another biography of Hecht after 30 years of silence have kind of emerged at the same time, which is extraordinary. And I think we have to ask, is that just a coincidence, or does it tell us something about history and literature and this moment? And the story arc, I think our two books kind of complement each other very nicely. And the story arc that I focused on was, here's a guy who comes up as a crime reporter in Chicago, invents the gangster movie at a time in Hollywood when you could invent a film genre.
The original Scarface.
First he writes Underworld as a silent film, and that's like really the first...
That's the first Oscar winner.
Yeah, right? and by the way, he won the Academy Award for First Story at the first Academy Awards.
Right.
And... And that was a box office success. And between that and everything that was happening with the violence with Al Capone, it woke people like Daryl Zanuck at MGM up, you know, woke him up to the possibility of gangster films. And so Hecht writes Scarface. So Hecht is this crime reporter who, you know, comes of age before the rise of Al Capone, but by the time of Al Capone, or, you know, just as that's as Al Capone is about ready to head to prison, he writes Scarface, this kind of gangster epic that puts the gangster film on the map. And then he gets involved with the Jewish politics and the Holocaust, and he kind of becomes radicalized. And in the fight for a Jewish state, he ends up partnering with a Jewish gangster, Mickey Cohen, to smuggle weapons to the Jews of Palestine in the fight for a Jewish state.
And even before that point, before the United States entered the war, he wrote a long piece in the American Mercury called The Extermination of the Jews, later excerpted in Reader's Digest. You write in your book that the only substantive coverage of the Holocaust to appear in mass circulation magazines in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of major themes in the book. They're all kind of wrapped into one narrative. But I mean, I'd say just to finish a thought, maybe sure. One of them is that this relationship between crime and politics and crime and geopolitics, mm-hmm. as it turns out, you know, seeing the Holocaust as like the greatest crime in history. Mm-hmm. So this connection between gangsters and his crime background and the way the war unfolds through his view are not unrelated. Mm-hmm. And then regarding the fact that he breaks through the media, that's part of a whole story of his lifelong experience with the media. And the, you know, to me, the main thing about this is that this book is the story of one of the greatest stories of the 20th century that the media kind of missed, the American mm-hmm. media. Mm-hmm. And so he broke through that. And I think that you almost, you know, I guess because I am Jewish, I don't know how many others have this education as a child, or whenever you talk about the Holocaust, you can't get away from the idea of talking about denial. And denial isn't just an issue with the Holocaust. It's an issue about our mass media and about the world today. So it's very resonant in that regard.
Talk about that a bit, because these events, as you say, from the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and yet the relevance of the story to events today.
I'd say a couple things about it. One is that the main theme that Hecht returns to in, I mean, this extraordinary prolific writer, but in just about every single thing that you'll read that he wrote, he returns to his main focus, which is the soul of man, the human nature. Hmm. And this is something that he began his education about as a crime reporter in Chicago.
And he doesn't always have a very generous view of the soul of man.
No, and you know, and by the way, neither, you know, the people who are also deeply questioning this were other major journalists of his generation that mm-hmm. lived through the First World War. Mm-hmm. Because Hecht was not only a crime reporter in Chicago, he then goes to Germany right in the aftermath of World War I and is a foreign correspondent in 1919 in Germany, where a lot of the corruption and the problems of human nature that he saw, say, on death row with the psychopaths in the Cook County Jail who are waiting hanging for murder, mm. and the gangsters of Chicago and the crooked, you know, politicians and cops of Chicago, he then sees in Germany, but he sees people getting cut down by machine gun fire, mm. and things like that. So the corruption is on now a greater scale, and he sees the human connection. And meanwhile, people like Walter Lippmann and H.L. Mencken, you know, they've all lived through the war, and they all have different takes on human nature and its mm-hmm. implications for both our democracy and the media. And Hecht had one take on that. They had another. I mean, I think he started with this very dark view because he had seen these criminals and also killers, but also with the rise of Nazi Germany, he saw that as a gangster regime. And so again, it was, you know, he had seen Al Capone's Chicago when he gets back from mm-hmm. Germany yeah. in the 20s. So a city, a government completely run by an organized criminal syndicate. And then a lot of people understood the rise of Nazi Germany as gangsterism. And there was the additional human nature aspect of bigotry, which hadn't you know, hadn't come to the fore, but it became, because I think of his Jewish background, became very much part of his understanding of the dark side of human nature.
So finally, in terms of what you might say about relevance of his story for where we are today.
One is this idea that he saw in the appeal to bigotry and in the appeal to people's darker side that politicians could have. You know, he saw that in Nazi Germany, but that those kind of appeals of scapegoating a minority and saying, you know, these are the cause of our problem, these are the cause of the Great mm-hmm. Depression, or we have a terrible economic problem and it's because of these outsiders mm-hmm. and politicians using that for advantage is one thing that I think mm-hmm. resonates with people today. A second thing that's also deeply related to human nature is our capacity for denial. So we definitely see that today. The kinds of things that we may be in denial about with our media today are not necessarily the Holocaust. People can make up their own minds of what they think is maybe the big story of the 21st century that we may be missing. But, you know, we've been, as a sort of species, we've been through the Holocaust, the atomic bomb, the nuclear arms race. In the 21st century, we've got this environmental crisis going on. And so I don't think there, it does seem anti-intuitive, I agree, that there'd be any connection between the Holocaust and, say, a major environmental story. But it depends on how you look at human nature and on the way that we are our own worst threat to ourselves and to the world.
The book is the notorious Ben Hecht, iconoclastic writer and militant Zionist. The author, Julian Gorbach, assistant professor at the School of Communications at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Julian, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Right now, as you listen to me speaking, you're creating a product that is extremely valuable. Your attention.
Attention is a resource. You own it. And that one should be very conscious about how it's being spent.
How media companies harvest your attention, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7, following Says You.
That's the program for today. Up tomorrow, an election. Online voting for Oahu's neighborhood board elections officially runs April 26th through May 17th. What do you need to know? Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and record your comments. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Catherine's back tomorrow. Join us then for more of The Conversation.